Hey, it's time for Dr. Lisa Gives a Shit. And I'm Dr. Lisa. How you doing? I give a shit. Everybody's in a good mood because it's going to be spring, right? We're starting to feel it. Spring always feels like hopeful, right? Especially right before spring. And then by the time you get into August, you're like, well, that's fucked up. Anyway, so thank you. I just want to say thank you for listening to Radio Free Brooklyn. We are 501c, which means that if you need a tax deduction, like you probably do, if you're listening to the station, you're in that category, you could donate to us. But seriously, folks, it's a really great station. It's radiofreebrooklyn.org. And we are in the middle of planning an 8th anniversary party. So I implore you to sign up for the newsletter so you can find out about it. It's coming up maybe in a really short amount of time. And then you could come, and I guarantee it will be fun. No doubt about it. Every party we've had has always been a blast. So, well, first of all, we have a really special day today because I have this very intense guest, and I'm dying to talk to him. His name's Pablo Elguera. He's a socially engaged artist, and we're going to talk to him in a second. But before we get to him, there's a lot to learn there. I'm very excited about this, guys. I wanted to give a plug. I want you guys to know about my new friend Amir. Why doesn't everybody have a name like Susan or Robert anymore? Fuck, I'm so bad at this. Amir Latif. Anyway, I met him. He's a trainer at Green Gym. Go to the gym and use the weights, okay? I don't care who you are, what skill. I started doing it because I read I need to, you know, and it's really good. So start doing that. And Amir took me through. I paid him a reasonable amount of money, took me through the course that I needed to learn, and now I can just do it on my own. But I wanted to tell you about him. He's great. So check him out at, what is this? It's LF. This is like, is it LF? IF? IFLXDLY. So it's IFLXDLY at Gmail. If you want to just contact him directly, or thatwholething.org, if you want to check out, you know, his schedule and his bio. Or if you just want to follow him on Instagram, same thing. And he is doing a 420 stretching event at Angel Noir, 247 Varitt Street, 10 a.m. It says 11:30, 420. Check him out. Okay, I'll put a link on my Facebook page so you can find him. But he's a really good guy, and he's like no bullshit trainer, and he's got a really good attitude, and he's got a really good idea about fitness. You know, it's not like not stupid. He's got a really good philosophy on it. So anyway. So now we get to Pablo, and before, I just want to give you a very, very, I got to stop talking because I really want Pablo to do the talking, but I'm just going to tell you about him really quickly. Hello, Pablo.
Hi, Lisa. A pleasure to be here. Thanks.
Did I say your name? Elguera.
Elguera.
Elguera. I did okay. So I'm just going to tell you guys, okay, really quickly about Pablo. Here's the thing. Pablo is an artist, but his body of work is so vast. He's not a person. He's an entire category. His work has been described as socially engaged, and he is passionate about creating works that engage communities in local or global issues. This is like just some of the things he does. He's an artist, performer, cartoonist, poet, writer, author of several books, advice columnist, lecturer, educator, professor, New School, husband, father. He can sing and write songs, which I just saw him do very recently at a great, hilarious show called Untitled Live Performance. And he got a BFA at Institute of Chicago. He's been worked at Department of Education for the Guggenheim and I think and MoMA, right?
Yes.
MoMA, like he's had these really good jobs in the art world at major institutions. He has a PhD from Kingston University. Can you believe I got this guy on my show? Like he's really actually here. Educator, yeah, Museum of Modern Art. There's a really long list of awards. There's a really long list of places he's exhibited at, performed, places that you've heard of. And so he's gotten awards. He's performed numerous. Oh, he's been written about a lot. New York Times, all that stuff. And he's represented by Kent Fine Art in New York. Did I cover? How did I do? I tried to make it quick.
It must be exhausting for everybody to listen to all that.
I know. So anyway, you know, you do your own research, guys. So anyway, it's so cool to have you here. So here's what I was thinking. So Pop, your work takes an enormous amount of different forms, and it's coming, like, it's like your whole being seems to want to interact with people. And you want to put, you have ideas that you want to impart and connect with people. Does that make sense?
Yeah. You know, I guess a mantra I've always had in my work is that content should inform the form. Like you start with an idea, a curiosity, a question, a suspicion of some kind, and then you pursue it, and whatever shape it takes, it's that is what the content will inform you. So sometimes mm-hmm. what I make, I don't know what final shape is going to have. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it takes the form of a trip. Sometimes it takes the form of a phonographic record. Sometimes it takes the form of the creation of a fictional artist. Sometimes it's a dinner. I have no idea. You know, you have to listen to where the content wants you to take
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
and that's why I cannot see myself as existing within a particular genre,
mm-hmm.
even
right.
though I have training for specific mm-hmm. genres. So, you know, but mm-hmm. I don't see myself in a particular tribe of mm-hmm. of artistic making per se.
Your output is so prolific, like. Are you really well? Like, how do you do it? Seriously.
You know, it's funny. I when I was a student, I had one of my first jobs. I was an intern in a museum, and my supervisor would tell me, like, Pablo, it's time to focus because you're doing too many things. You know, you're too scattered. You know, you will never accomplish anything if you do not focus. And he was right. But I still have not focused.
Well, you put a lot out there. Let's. You've had a lot, and I think you're. You know, personally, I mean, as well as I know you and your work, I think you're a very influential person in the art world. I do. For for good, because you call the art world out on its, let's call it hypocrisy, or what it really is. You're very honest. You're not pretentious. You poke holes in the pretension.
Well, you know, I'm interested in human behavior.
Mm-hmm.
And that's partially because of my training as an arts educator. You have to pay attention to conversations, to people's reactions, to people's mm-hmm. behavior in general, mm-hmm. so that you can help them have particular experiences. Because of that interest in human behavior, over the years, I could not help but notice, like, particular social dynamics mm-hmm. that would occur within my community, which is the art world, right? Mm-hmm. And how dealers treat artists and how artists treat like non-artists and how curators treat the collectors, et cetera. And like all these different types of dynamics that for the most part, I felt I had to learn by myself. Many of these are unspoken. So I wanted to like spell them out. And I often did it in a satirical way because, of course, I come from a generation that learned from institutional critique and from artists who were doing this kind of work, like Andrea Fraser and so forth.
Yeah.
Right? But I wanted to do it in a way that, I don't know, I would do it my own way.
Yes.
So I often used satire. I often use humor. But I also wanted to do it in a constructive way. I wanted to do critique not by simply being a negative critic, but by proposing new paradigms or new forms of interaction, which is what led me to social practice.
I also think like you've published books of cartoons. I mean, you're funny on stage. You use humor a lot. But I think it's a way of sort of, I think that you use humor in a way that sort of is very inclusive of having everybody kind of laugh at themselves, because we're all, you know, we're all subject to whatever the art world dynamic is, and we recognize it, and it's funny.
Yeah, humor is a wonderful way of self-recognition. I saw a lecture by William Kentridge. I organized a lecture by Kentridge where he said a really beautiful thing about humor. And I hope I'm not going to botch his quote, but what he actually said, which was amazing, was like, when you are, let's say you are seeing a shadow play with hands, right? And you see the hand making like the shape of a dog, you know, or whatever it is, and you laugh, you know. And he says, when you're laughing, you're laughing at three things. You're laughing at the funny shape of the dog. Then you're laughing about the way in which the dog was made with the hand gestures. You know, you see the process by which this image is produced, right? But also you're laughing at yourself because you're laughing at your own credulity. And it's just such a beautiful thing to say.
Yeah.
That we are complicit with this game where we are, this fake image of a dog is being shown to us and we know it's false and we think it's cute and we laugh at the thing, but we're laughing with the humorist, with the artist. So humor in that sense, it's like a form of complicity.
Right. Well, I think that's what is really kind of compelling about your work, is that It does poke holes. It does, you know, poke holes in myths and pretensions, but in a way that is sort of positive, which in a way just saying, hey, look, we're human. Look what we're all doing. And it's very positive and inclusive. And I think it makes people, more open.
It's a form of being critical of ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, and poke fun at our own ridiculousness, you know, without being insulting.
Right. A very hard needle to thread. But there's so much we have to get to. So you're from Mexico City.
Yes.
Right. And tell us, there's a couple of things I want to talk. These are all the things that I want to talk about that I think are related. I want to hear how you came to America. I want to hear about the project you did. I think it was one of your first projects about the where you crossed all of America at your moving. You know what I'm talking about. Yes. What is it called?
It's called the School of Pan-American Unrest.
Right. And then I want to talk about the project you're doing with your brother, too. So let's get going. I'm under a lot of pressure. This guy has so much going on, and I'm afraid I'm not even going to get halfway there in an hour. So we got to get going.
Okay, well, just to tell you quickly. So I am from Mexico City, born and raised there. And I grew up in a middle-class neighborhood in Mexico City. My family were all our musicians. like professional, like wow. classical musicians, which is a weird thing in Mexico City to think. People, when you think Mexico, you think like the Virgin of Guadalupe and cactuses and maybe like Mexican food, but you don't imagine a quartet playing like a Haydn, which is what I grew up listening to every single day.
Wow.
Like in my household, my sister was playing Bach in the morning. My brother was listening to Ravel and Debussy, and my other sister was like, playing cello, rehearsing a sonata or something.
So they were all professional musicians.
All of professional musicians, yes.
Wow. And your siblings too.
And and my dad, which is interesting, he wanted to be a musician, but my grandfather wanted him to be a businessman and keep the family business alive.
Oh.
Which was we sold toilets.
Love it.
And he sold a kitchen and bathroom supplies. Okay. The entrance of our house, which was the garage, essentially, of like the house where we lived, he kind of retrofitted it to be more of a showroom. So you would enter into my house and it will be like five toilets, you know, very Duchampian, in fact. And actually a display of tiles, which is very minimalistic, like Sol de Witt. So it's funny, like when I go back to my museum life or my early life, I realized that I learned everything about museums in that showroom.
Oh, yeah.
Like it was all about display.
Right. That's so weird.
So that was my first, my first exposure with modernism and conceptual art was like the bathroom showroom of my dad in Colonia Napolis in Mexico City.
Wow. Yeah. Wow.
So I had that and then like the music all day.
Wow.
At home. And wow. then books, and which was the other part of the family, was like writers. Uh-huh. So
you have writers in your family?
A lot of writers. My grandfather wanted to be a novelist. He was a terrible writer, but he collected a million books. He self-published a bunch of books. I was surrounded. You know, I am the last analog generation. Mm-hmm. I did not see a computer until I was maybe like 12.
Wow.
And my internet were books. Mm-hmm. Was the family library, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's where I would do my homework. Mm-hmm. I would like try to like pull out encyclopedias and copy.
You know, remember? Wow, whatever, I relate to that. To copy, you know, you kids don't know what you're missing.
And the encyclopedias were, of course, all dated. You know, because mm-hmm. I was using encyclopedias from like the 1960s.
You know, because you didn't have those door-to-door salesmen like they do in America, probably.
Anyway, so that's the context where I mm-hmm. grew up. You know, mm-hmm. and then I wanted to be a painter. I had these, I guess, ability to draw.
Mm-hmm.
And then I wanted to be, of course, you know, being a Mexican kid, being a muralist, I wanted to be Diego Rivera.
Oh, yeah. Right?
And my sister, who was in Chicago, who had married a Chicagoan musician, she had told me there's a school there that you might want to apply to. And I, of course, had my sights in Paris. I had like this romantic idea of like what an artist. I mean, I had a 1920 idea of what an artist.
Well, the encyclopedias did that, I'm sure.
and that would. So, but I thought, well, I guess Chicago is like, you know what I'm going to have to do.
She was right.
I had no idea that where I was going. Uh-huh. I was going to the School of the Institute of Chicago, which is a major, really important school.
Yeah, really good school.
And furthermore, once I get there, I get confronted by the culture wars, which were.
Really?
They were raging. It was like this 1989.
Mm.
Okay, this is right after my now friend Dred Scott had burned the flag in the steps
Scott.
Of the Institute, and where he had produced a major work about the flag.
Wow!
It was the time of Karen Finley and Andre Serrano and Robert Mapplethorpe
and the NEA.
This was super powerful times.
Yeah.
And I was like, I couldn't make sense of it. I was like, what's going on here?
What's wrong with these Americans?
And then, of course, all my classmates were making work about bodily fluids. And
oh, yeah, right. I can imagine.
There was an obsession with the bodily fluids.
A lot of tampons in that class.
A lot of tampons. and more.
You know? Yeah. College students, that frightens me.
So I had it was difficult for me to embrace that. But At the same time, I was struggling with painting, which I thought I was a painter, and then I ended up like discovering performance art, and that changed my life.
Yeah, what happened?
Well, I was making these paintings that nobody liked. You know, they were like these gigantic paintings, like shaped canvases, and my painting professors who were Chicago Images, they were like, they were a great group of artists who were inspired in pop, but they were making a very Chicago version of pop.
Let me ask you a question, because your background had been just different. Did you not have the same perspective? I mean, it was probably a good thing, but like they had all been, had these influences. Did you feel like you didn't have the same influences that the other kids had?
Yes, I felt like I had a completely different.
Yeah.
I was brought up with a deep reverence for history and for universal history.
World history.
For world history.
Not American.
I was kind of like bored. Like I felt that many of my classmates didn't share any passions at all. They were just interested in pop culture. And I was like, I was a complete idiot in pop culture. I knew nothing about... My problem is that I knew nothing about pop culture.
Mm.
You know, I knew nothing about rock. I knew nothing about like sports.
You didn't know about rock music?
I'm a very ignorant of rock music.
Oh, wow.
I like, but because I was brought up listening to Mozart.
Yeah, you were brought up in an intellectual environment.
It was really crazy. You know, I mean, like I was like so incompetent understanding that world.
I think that's a superpower, frankly, because then you have more deeper perspective. But go ahead.
But so all my classmates were also like interested in heavy metal and things like that. That were, to me, were so alien. I just, what the hell is this?
That's hilarious.
But I felt I had so many things to deal with, and I painting was so frustrating. I couldn't really figure it out. So finally, I took a class that was called actually storytelling. With Michael Myers, who was a local Chicago artist, who is still around. He's fantastic. And that changed my life because I discovered what performance art was. And I realized, wow, anything can be a performance. Like this hand gesture can be a performance. Like this putting like a little object in the corner is a performance. Like anything can be a performance. And that blew my mind, you know. And then I started making these like tableaus, you know, with music and with like costumes and with my crazy canvases that then they were used as props, and people loved them as props.
Did you perform, or was it more of a like
I started performing and the writing texts, and then it started evolving into like more narrative pieces. But what I enjoyed was that the performance was not a, it was not a genre that would like dictate a particular formal qualities,
right?
Like it's not like you need to stretch the canvas and this is what you do with this particular technique.
It was totally wide open.
It was wide open. And I just loved it. It was incredible to me, you know?
So you felt like really found yourself.
So I found myself in that moment. At the same time, and I'll get to the Pan American Project.
Okay, you know, go ahead.
At the same time, I need a job, right? Because I need to figure out how to like survive, right? And I get an internship in a museum in the neighborhood of Pilsen, which is the Mexican neighborhood of Chicago. One of the Mexican neighborhoods of Chicago. And there was a tiny museum called the Mexican Fine Arts Museum that hired me to be an intern there in the education department. And because they noticed that I was doing performance, they thought that I would be good at organizing conversations or panel discussions. So I ended up becoming a public programmer, which is a very rare,
Kind
of like aspect of the education department in that museum.
Oh, wow. That's great.
So I ended up doing that for 29 years.
Wow.
In maybe 7 different museums.
Wow. You know? Wow. Because you're really curious about what people think and you want people to share with. That's great. That's a great service. We need more of that.
Yeah. So I learned a ton about art. And then the museum inadvertently for me became kind of like my studio, like a place or like laboratory where I was observing people.
Yeah. Right?
I mean, I ended up working in museums like the MCA, which was the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago, where I ran the public programs there.
Wow.
Then I got a job at the Guggenheim when I did the same thing for 7 years.
And that's how you came to New York. They hired you, right?
And they hired me at the Guggenheim and then at MoMA. Exciting.
That must have been so exciting to come to New York to work at the Guggenheim.
Yeah, it was incredible. I mean, it was, being in Chicago, I always felt, you know, we were bringing artists from New York, and I always felt that
it must have been amazing. That how old were you?
I was 27.
Ah, so good.
It was really interesting.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I continued with these conversations, and then now to get to the part that you were asking me. What I also noticed as a Mexican immigrant, as a Latin American, was I started noticing the cultural dynamics of people who were from the Americas, from Latin America, and how we felt connected culturally by language, by culture, by many other things, you know, and I started thinking more about what really connects us as Americans.
Mm-hmm.
And during that time, the whole notion of the European Union was really important.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was still like considered very strong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know that now the notion of the European Union is kind of discredited because of various reasons, but we also acknowledge that how important it is, you know, to be integrated. And my question was really, why are we not integrated in the Americas? And why is this American hegemony so powerful? And I wanted to explore the notion of Pan-Americanism, which was an idea from the 19th century that existed in Jefferson's thought, as well as in Simón Bolívar's thought, who was the liberator of South America.
We think of South America, and we think of even Mexico and Canada as like completely different countries, almost like they're different continents, but we're all on the same continent.
Well, Mexico is North America. Which is interesting.
Is it? Look how ignorant I am.
Yeah, well, North America is Mexico, Canada, and the United States.
I didn't know that, Mexico. Well, Jesus.
And there you go, folks.
In
order to blow your mind, too, like the official name of Mexico is the United States.
Really?
It's the United States of Mexico.
That's so funny. That's so funny. But do you see what I mean, guys? Like, we don't think of the Americas as one unit. Like, it's amazing. Go ahead.
So I then at the time Creative Capital, the big organization had just more or less started, and I was broke. I had just quit my job at the Guggenheim because I was like tired of the museum and we work. And I applied for this grant, and I wrote like the most like, I don't know, hallucinogenic grant, where I basically claimed I was going to drive from Alaska to Chile, you know, to do this project. And, little did I know, I actually got the grant.
Wow, you must have been like.
I remember I was very sick the day I wrote the grant.
Oh, really?
I was like, had a cold. I was like feeling like shit. And
right, yeah.
Anyway, I write this grant and they submit it, thinking I was never going to get it anyway. But the grants as narratives, like to me, are inspiring to come up with a crazy idea, right?
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, now I have to do this.
Oh wow!
and I was like, and I hate driving. I cannot stand.
That's hilarious! That must have been how Trump felt when he won the presidency. Now I have to be the president. I don't even like being. I don't even want to do that.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it's like now. So you must have been like,
no,
wow.
I mean, I have horror driving.
Really?
And then I had to drive 20,000 miles.
And were you doing this alone?
Yeah.
Wow.
Well, because
can I ask how much money did you get?
Oh, the grant at the time?
Did it pay for everything?
Well, I mean, it sounds like a ton of money, but it was like maybe $30,000. But
$30,000? That does sound like a lot of money.
But you know,
yeah.
I mean, this is a project that lasted 5 years, okay?
Oh, wow.
And also, I had to build a schoolhouse. I had to purchase a van, and I had to pay for gas for 20,000 miles. So that,
right. No, that, I get it.
I mean,
that's a huge undertaking.
It doesn't even cover like half of it.
So it's like a whole lifestyle change.
Oh yeah. I have to like
whole
dedicate
life
my life completely to this thing.
Yeah. That's so crazy.
No, it was insane.
So you really drove from Tell.
So I purchased a van from an electrician in Anchorage. Mm-hmm. It's like a Chevy cargo van.
So you started in honestly, we have to get the everything. So you started, so I'm going to try and we're going to condense this. You bought a van you started in Alaska.
In Anchorage, yes.
Yeah. And then what was your goal? You were going to drive to Chile and what was?
I was going to drive all the way to the southern tip of Argentina.
So you were going to drive from the northernmost part of the Americas to the southernmost part?
Yes.
Is that the goal? And what were you going to?
Well, the idea was to drive the entirety of the Pan American Highway, which is the largest highway in the world. It's the longest highway in the world. It's essentially a continuous road that is really more like the interconnection of different highways.
Mm-hmm.
But that does receive the name of the Pan American Highway. Mm-hmm.
And so this was pre-GPS.
Pre-GPS.
Okay.
Yeah, you could have MapQuest, but that was like really a little clunky. You would have to print the map.
Yeah.
And then use the map to follow the... I mean, it was really crazy.
Yeah.
And this is before social media. This is before Facebook or Twitter or... Facebook existed, but no one really used it.
So you were driving this whole thing by yourself. And what was your goal? What was the idea?
The idea was that to every city, I would find a host, prearranged to find like a little art center or something that will receive me. We will have a conversation about something a topic that they chose connected to their city or to their country.
Uh-huh.
Then we will do a workshop and do a collective like act. We would write a Pan American speech together.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would drive to the next place.
Mm-hmm. So what kind of experiences were you accumulating?
Oh, it was incredible.
Oh, I can't imagine.
I mean, so I was carrying this collapsible schoolhouse that was kind of like a giant yellow tent with a bell, and where we would run it kind of like an art center, basically. So I will have to erect the schoolhouse wherever I was and then have the conversation, the workshop, and the performance, uh-huh. and then move on to the
wow.
next place.
So how many stops about did you make?
I must have made around 30 stops, mm-hmm. like official stops.
And what did you get out of it? What did you learn that you didn't know before you went in? Like, what did you learn about humanity and about the Americas? I know we're trying to sum this up,
it's really difficult.
Impossible.
But I mean, what I...
How did that influence you as an artist? I think that's what I kind of want to know.
But first, one thing that I realized, I discovered, is that we are not that different.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this sounds like a completely, kind of frivolous thing to observe. But,
no.
But I was stricken by how similar conversations were in a place like in the mountains, you know, or like a place like Anchorage, in like the Sonora Desert, or in Ushuaia, which is like, the idea, notions about being remote, being marginalized, and being forgotten were common. Cultural dynamics between cities were common. Mm-hmm. The legacy of colonialism, of course, is very important, and also of the North-South relations.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all these were common themes.
That you got to internalize.
I was coming to these places as an educator with my training as educator to kind of generate debates, you know?
Mm-hmm.
But sometimes that was hard because people saw me sometimes as this external agent. Like, for example, in Venezuela, I mean, I get there right in the amidst Hugo Chavez's second election, re-election.
Mm, wow.
This is a time when that Chavez has already completely control of the country, where this whole authoritarian regime he's created is basically now fully in place. And he has actually taken in the whole idea of Pan-Americanism, of Bolivarianism, as a rhetorical device to create a new world order, where Venezuela is at the center, which of course was really problematic for a lot of people. So people saw my project as also problematic in that sense. It's like, you're coming to us to talk about the integration and look what he's doing with these ideas. You know?
So they thought it was sort of like maybe hypocritical or too little or
naive.
Naive. Yeah, I could see what you mean.
At the same time, kind of people saw me kind of as like this American invader.
Yeah, even
because
though,
of course here right. I'm an artist from New York, and like of course there's also a lot of animosity toward that, the elitism of New York,
right?
New York
well,
art world,
you know? I can, in all fairness, I can see how somebody in a remote place, or you know, somebody who doesn't know who's not educated about art, could see it as frivolous. And I don't think it's not. I know it's not.
But you know, the second thing I also realized was that New York is really not that important for the majority of people.
Yeah.
Or like the art world is not even that important. It's like nobody really cared.
Yeah.
You know, and whether I was an artist or not, it kind of mattered less and less. So the more south I went, you know, and also the whether the project was an artwork or not also started mattering less and less.
Huh.
I was just basically this guy who was driving from Alaska.
Wow.
And it didn't really matter how you called it.
Right. And did you have a final result for it, or did creative capital get anything, or?
Well, the project became this gigantic archive of hours and hours of video and thousands of photographs and texts. Yeah, it's heavily documented.
Mm-hmm. And where is it? Is it on your website?
There's a website.
For it, on your website.
There's a Pan-American, School of American Unrest website.
Uh-huh, okay.
That you can see the ended up calling the Pan-American Diary. Like I was kind of acting like a journalist.
Mm-hmm.
Like I will have a blog because at the time that's how you did things. You know, you just have a blog. And then where every day I will have to write a report of what happened.
Oh, wow.
So day 25, I'm in Guatemala and this is what's happening in Guatemala right now.
Did it get exhausting? Did you get lonely?
It got really difficult. I don't know if it's the loneliness. It was, to me, the emotional exhaustion of dealing. I mean, like, there were things that I was not prepared to deal with. And mostly, one of the things that were difficult were the border issues. Crossing the border by foot is really taxing emotionally and physically.
By foot?
Well, I was driving, but you know, you will be on the ground, in this kind of like sometimes like nowhere land, you know.
Oh yeah, that could be crazy.
I was subjected to tons of extortion and
abuse.
And it was very difficult.
Wow.
I observed a lot of poverty and suffering from people.
Yeah,
that was also difficult.
Yeah,
because I'm just there to document. I'm not there with the means to kind of solve people's problems.
Right.
So I always try to keep like a firewall, I suppose, an emotional firewall. But it became harder and harder as I went down.
Right,
and I also like. Was unable to really address my own
needs. Yeah.
So toward the very end, when I was in Argentina, I was in a very deep state of depression.
I'm sorry. I mean, it's not funny, but I mean, it's so remarkable and must in the big picture must be so rewarding for you to have had the experience.
Yeah. I mean, it was what it showed me. Oh, it was an endurance project for sure.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and
but to have a perspective of humanity is to get in a perspective is like,
yeah, I mean,
so
that project is really like a, I don't know. It's just like a snapshot of a moment in the Americas.
Mm-hmm.
And this is in 2006.
So you started talking about this project that you were doing with your brother and your brother are doing about your brother, and your brother sounds like a really huge influence on you and a very rare sort of influence for a child to grow up with. And I wanted to hear more about that.
Yeah. So my brother was his name was Luis Ignacio Elguera.
Mm-hmm.
He was a poet and a philosopher, and he was 9 years older than me. That means that when I was 10, he was 19.
Mm-hmm.
And also when I was a kid, he was already in university, mm-hmm. and he was also very precocious. And he, at the time, was really into philosophy. And we, you know, shared a room, you know, we were together all the time. And it was interesting because our games and our and his intellectual interests kind of all merged. So he would just like read me stories as if they were like fairy tales of mm-hmm. like, I mean, this is going to sound crazy to people, but he would read me like, talk to me about Plato and Aristotle and so, and Jean-Paul Sartre and Camus and Heidegger, who was his obsession.
When you were like 10?
I was like 10 or 11. Wow. He would be like, do you know what Heidegger said about the Dasein?
No. He'll say that to you. No. I don't.
He would ask me questions about, like, you know, St. Thomas Aquinas and St. Augustine about ideas of memory and being and death. And he made me read many different like writers and novelists. Mm-hmm. And that was to me normal. Like, but it was normal for me to, as a 12-year-old, to actually know these things.
That's amazing what I'm thinking is, it's amazing that he got you to do it. Like, you must have really respected him, or you must have, like, how did you process that? What made you go along with it?
Well, I mean, when you have an older sibling, you know, they become your role model, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's, they're much more.
Not always,
yes, but.
He was for you, for sure.
It was fun.
What about him? There were other brothers.
I have two sisters who are musicians, mm-hmm. who I love. Of course, they're fantastic.
Were you the youngest?
I was the youngest.
Yeah.
I'm the youngest.
Yeah.
What happened was my brother passed away. Mm, he had an accident, and it's actually almost exactly 20 years ago.
Oh.
You know. What's interesting is I was the artist. In families, usually what happens with siblings is like, somehow the way things get rearranged is like, oh, you're the artist, you're the writer, you're the music, you're like, you right. people get jobs or roles. You're the one who cooks, you're the one who organizes, you're the one who does this or that. Anyway, I was the artist. I was the, like, mm-hmm. but like the cartoonist, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And my brother was a writer, and mm-hmm. I had never written, mm-hmm. or I never saw myself as a writer.
Mm-hmm.
The year after he passed away, a friend of his told me, like, oh, we're starting a little, like, publishing company, editorial imprint here in Mexico City. Mm-hmm. Do you want to write something about art? And I told them, like, I would love to write this, like, etiquette manual for the art world.
Oh.
You know, like, we'll tell you, like, who to sleep with and...
Oh, that's hilarious.
And how to talk about the work of your friend if you don't like the work. So I wrote this book called The Pablo Elguera Manual of Contemporary Art Style, mm-hmm. which was my first book.
Mm-hmm.
It's a social etiquette manual for the art world. So it tells you how to write a press release. It tells you how to what is the social choreography that you have to follow in an opening, mm-hmm. and so forth, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was a joke, of course. It was in the style of Ambrose Bierce's The Devil's Dictionary,
mm-hmm.
and of many other books of that nature.
It was humorous, but rooted in real truth.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And also drawn from my observations as a museum employee.
Mm-hmm. Right.
That of the things that I lived every single day, right. that I know
you,
exactly.
You were, right.
I mean, like, it's like decades of observing curators and artists.
Sure.
And dealers and mm-hmm. like in all sorts of social interactions.
And you wrote that a long time ago now, right? Is it still, and it's probably still pretty relevant.
Things
have not changed much.
It's true. It's true. It was published in 2005 originally.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, interestingly, I wrote it in Spanish,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is also weird because.
You don't think
you would,
of that
you will as. Wonder, you will wonder how is it going to play in that our world. But right. interestingly, it functioned perfectly in both. What happens is in the art world.
You mean in English and Spanish?
Yeah, in either language.
You had it.
Basically, the social dynamics of the art world are universal.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I believe that.
And it has, I have observed it constantly. Like now, recently, a second version of what I do now were these cartoons that we can talk about in a minute. But
mm-hmm.
A gallery from Ramallah contacted me to have been a show that they are organizing about the art world, and they wanted me to submit some of my work that deals with these things. And I told them, like, you know, I don't know if people are going to understand it, because what I write about is so much about New York,
mm-hmm.
and about the dynamics of New York. Mm-hmm. And they told me, like, oh, no, here's exactly the same.
Oh, yeah.
It's like here, there's like this, like really annoying, like, I don't know, a curator who's really hierarchical and really pretentious. And like, in other words,
yeah.
The dynamics of, the social and professional dynamics of art, as in almost anything else,
mm-hmm.
I really know the difference.
Well, I think of it as a very global community, and at the top, at the highest level of the art world, it's really just, I mean, I see it as a social group of people traveling from country to, I actually see it as a social group of people traveling from country to country, almost on shopping and travel tours. You know, like, so, I mean, that's very cynical, but it is, you know, all the biennials all over the world. And
yeah, it's
always luxury. It always feels like luxury.
The commerce parts of the art world, of course, is like the most evident.
Right.
In like the art, uh-huh. the art first is like the most clear, right? And but we also share this universal language of conceptual art.
You know? Absolutely.
So like everybody knows Duchamp. Everybody knows like.
Yeah, I guess that's like, true too.
I mean, so there's this the kind of common of language, you know.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
That we also share, and like where I think references that I was making to these things make sense
mm-hmm.
here or mm-hmm. like in the other part of the world, mm-hmm. you know.
Which you probably also understand well from the trip that you went on.
Yeah, so that's the other thing that I learned from that Pan American project, that, you know, we are in a sense a republic of contemporary art.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In other words, I noticed that what I was doing, I was connecting with people who, the people who wanted to connect with me, primarily were those who wanted to connect with this, were hoping to connect with this art, conversation, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. not in a like a commercial way,
yeah, that artists, right.
but more like connecting with other artists,
right?
With
right. ideas, that, right? That like matter. You can always go somewhere, and like right now, I'm thinking about going to Togo because I know I've got in touch with somebody who's doing a performance festival there. You know, like you, artists are everywhere. It's a religion, like in a way.
Yeah, exactly. It's shared. Set of ideals and,
yeah.
and thoughts about the power of art. Right?
Yeah, and it's idealistic, and it's, there's an idealism in it too.
Yes, and then I was able to notice too how their concerns really were very similar. Whether you were in like Mexicali, in like the north of Mexico, or you were in Guatemala City, or you were in El Salvador, or they were. Concerns about being off-center and how mm-hmm. the center sees you,
mm-hmm.
About how, what is your role in telling the story of the place where you're from,
mm-hmm.
and how do you contend with that with the evils of history around you, whether it's civil wars or
right.
or violence
right.
or
right.
and how do you deal with that, or do you try to create an alternative world where that to help people escape from that.
Right.
So yeah. those were really important debates that,
yeah.
that interestingly, were way more interesting to me in places like Central America and South America than in the United States. Mm-hmm. Because here, what I was encountering when I did the project was like a lot of comfort. You know, people will show up with their... People will show up very comfortable with their, mm-hmm. you know, cup of coffee and hang out and talk about the Americas in this kind of like mm-hmm. romantic way. But in El Salvador, we're talking about the Civil War that and people losing their families to the violence of the Civil War.
Wow.
And people who meet being an artist amidst that.
That yeah, reality. Wow. So think that, about that.
So that stuff is like completely different.
Completely different.
Than when you are like in a kind of like
with your MFA
in a nice yeah. like in an MFA program with yeah. your Starbucks talking about the Americas.
Yeah. You know? Well, that is stuff that is so good to like recognize, and we need to think more about that kind of stuff. How if you're going to make art, you're going to make art. But you know, we only have like 10 minutes left, and I wanted to talk about your. You know, your projects that you're working on and, but I just wanted to hear about your brother's influence on you, because I imagine that he, like, all that philosophy and all that thinking and all that as a young person, like that must have really put you in a much, I can't imagine how that affected you. And I just wanted to hear about that.
Yeah, it's a long topic, but what I can say is that, so my brother was a, he was a phenomenologist. He was very interested in this branch of philosophy, which is phenomenology, which is the understanding the nature of something, you know, and hermeneutics. How will you communicate that? Mm-hmm. That completely became my, the leitmotif of my life as an artist. For first, because I became, I by accident became an art educator, which is it's a discipline that does just that. Understand an artwork, understand what it means, you know, and help others understand that. But then it became part of my practice as an artist because I realized the world requires that of you. You know, like you need to go out there and try to understand something. And to me, the Pan American project was that, you know, going out there and trying to understand, like, you don't, not from distance, but you just need to drive to Guatemala and be there to understand what it means, you know.
So he really, what he kind of did was open up your curiosity in an infinite way.
He gave me a path for an artistic method and of research and communication. And he gave me language, which is incredibly important to me. Like stories are incredibly important to me. So everything that I do involves research, involves trying to understand a problem, and then a method to talk about it, whether through a story or something else. And this current column that I created 2 years ago is kind of like, for the first time, I tried to open up this process to people.
Yeah, tell us about that. What's the name? What's the name of it?
So I joined Substack, which is this open platform, which is essentially like a blogging platform.
You guys know what
it's a free.
Is.
It's a free.
They know what that is.
It's a free blog.
Yeah, we're all inundated with them. Yep.
Yes. Now everybody has one.
Right? Yeah. No. Not as many as podcasts like this, but
yeah, or, I know.
Well, radio show.
But whatever.
Yeah. No. Okay. But then, okay.
That was to me the platform that I felt I needed to use. So it's titled Beautiful Eccentrics, and every week I write about something that's in my mind. That I feel is not something that's being discussed by the general art press. In other words, it's not something that is either a review of a show, or it's not talking about auction prices or gossip about museum director salaries or stuff like that. That's not interesting to me. I'm interested in more deeper questions about art.
Can you give us a couple of? I mean, that sounds awesome. Awesome and necessary and not done enough. So can you give us an idea of
that? So this week I wrote about artworks that have multiple, that I call them blank screens. It's a story about how there's artworks that we see and we can interpret whatever we like from them and it makes sense. That there's like whatever you read in it makes sense.
So like an abstract painting?
But not always. But I mean, there's artworks that they're just like, can mean anything to anybody, and they have this ability to constantly re-signify. It's like the holy grail of art making. Like you make something that means something different to everybody, and that it's interesting. So I wrote about that. Let's say last week I wrote about tiny art.
Like really small things.
About a little project, like working in miniature. I wrote an art. Sometimes I write more provocative articles. I wrote an article making critical of this phrase by Joseph Beuys, everyone is an artist, which I think is bullshit because I don't think everybody's an artist. I think that it's a disservice to the profession. It's not that nobody can be creative. Everybody can be creative, but you can. No, not everybody is a brain surgeon. Nobody's
right. You mean not everybody has a practice of an artist. Everybody's creative, which is different than being an artist.
I wanted to like put in question this whole idea that everybody, that art is everywhere and it's done by everybody. You know, because that's not true. You know, and to say that also does not help you to understand anything, whether the good or the bad arts. You know, like
right.
And it's, But it's yet something that's continually used in this kind of democratizing effort to appreciate art, which is very noble, but it's very misguided, because then it shows that maybe then art has no criteria.
right.
So
that
you
initiate
the art, and then it's like, should be as fantastic as like the best art in the world, right? Like, why even bother making good art since everything is fantastic?
But how can you, you know, like, quality, it is very subjective. I mean, it is kind of a squishy thing.
Well, but you know, it's...
But I know what you mean.
Well, I mean, I can just throw like a few notes on the piano right now, and then... You know, I think, I'm sure it's not going to be a masterpiece.
Right. Well, there's like an intention and a discipline and a commitment to doing anything well.
Well, why do we spend our entire lives trying to make art well? You know, since like there's no criteria by which you make it well.
Right.
So anyway, this phrase has always bothered me, because it kind of like tries to minimize all those, the art practice itself. Mm-hmm. So everything that I write is a provocation. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
It's not an attempt to say this is the truth,
mm-hmm.
but it's trying to chip away at assumptions that we have
right.
about art or other things. You know?
So it sounds like a lot of what you're really doing, which is a real gift, I think, is that you are really trying to get people to think. Like, you don't necessarily, I think you've got a set of ethics, a very strong value, you know, set of ethics, but I don't think you necessarily have a particular agenda. You want people to think. Is that
yeah,
the question?
I don't believe in ideologies. Like, I mean, I don't feel like I'm trying to convert anybody to anything.
You're not trying to teach anybody.
I am trying to understand the world in uh-huh. the same way that we all are trying, uh-huh. right? And I find it interesting. And
so
I,
your art is sort of like making up, is sort of questioning. Your art is really about questioning in a way.
Yeah, I mean, although of course that's that cliche of like, I'm just asking questions, which is like
a cop-out.
You know?
No, but you're not asking questions. You're creating dialogue.
I'm trying to direct attention to problems that I see,
mm-hmm.
you know,
mm-hmm.
that I find interesting. I say, like, mm-hmm. let's look at this right now and maybe give it a little bit of scientific thought of, like, what does it mean? How can we see this problem in different angles? And as Howard Gardner once said, the psychologist, he said, you know, maybe the best outcome of the research is to ask a new question.
Mm.
In other words, like, it's not that we're going to find the solution.
You know what? I'm going to stop you there, because I want to make sure we get in all the, like, you know, URLs and Instagrams and stuff. So tell people where they can get the Substack.
Yes. So the beautiful eccentric Substack, you can either go to the Substack platform and search beautiful eccentrics, or you can go to Pablo Helguera. It's PabloHelguera.substack.com. And it's a free newsletter. You write your email there, and then you'll get the free weekly.
I did it. Yeah.
Column, right? And then and you can look at the archive too, so you can see what mm-hmm. whatever sounds interesting to you.
And your website, which is like a whole encyclopedia on its own, but let's tell it.
It's PabloHelguera.net, and mm-hmm. and again, the way it's organized is keywords.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to, you know, search like opera. Mm-hmm. Or poetry, or Mexico, mm-hmm. or whatever. Like,
it has a list. It's kind of it's pretty navigatable, and it crosses so many interests, like, you know, like music and cartoons and books, and it's just it's really it's amazing.
Well, it's just like.